Michael Flaherty is the president and co-founder of Walden Media. Walden's stated mission is to rekindle curiosity and recapture imagination through the development and production of family films and literature. Walden has financed and produced a number of films, such as The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, Charlotte's Web, Bridge to Terabithia, Holes, Because of Winn-Dixie, and Journey to the Center of the Earth 3D. Through its publishing division, Walden has also co-published a number of award-winning books, including Mike Lupica's Comeback Kids series and the New York Times bestseller and Newbery Honor winner, Savvy, by first-time author Ingrid Law. As part of its mission, Walden creates innovative educational programs, lesson plans, and events. Several hundred thousand students have participated in these events, including an international effort to read Charlotte's Web aloud and to collect toys for tots. Mr. Flaherty is also on the board of Rachel's Challenge, a program created in memory of Rachel Scott, the first victim of the Columbine shootings. He's also a member of the Global Advisory Council of Vision 360, an organization dedicated to supporting and founding churches across the country. Mr. Flaherty lives in Lexington, Massachusetts, with his wife, Kelly, his son, Christian, and his daughters, Eileen and Reagan, and his dog, Jumbo. Would you please join me in welcoming Michael Flaherty to Brigham Young University?
Dr. Key, thanks so much for that generous introduction. My wife, who's home right now watching us on BYU TV, will be happy to know that you called one of our daughters Jumbo. I actually lost that fight. But we called her Reagan after the greatest president of the last century, so she's doing okay in the name department. I especially want to thank the people who invited me here to be a forum speaker. As you guys all know, this is one of the greatest speaking programs in the country. It attracts world leaders, brilliant professors, Supreme Court justices, astronauts, best-selling authors, and international faith leaders. And now, for some reason, you want to add to that list the president of a Hollywood film company. That's quite a leap of faith, even for people here at BYU. Let's face it, those of us in the movie business, we haven't developed the best reputation. I don't think many of us parents pray for the day when our child tells us they're going to work in the movie business. And I don't think that many of us fathers hope to get a phone call one day from one of our daughters telling us that they're engaged to the man of their dreams, a movie producer. Working in the movie business ranked at the bottom of potential careers for me when I was growing up. It was somewhere between international jewel thief and miniature golf course designer. I grew up 3,000 miles away from Hollywood in Boston, Massachusetts. But I was blessed to grow up in a house that loved stories. My mother, a pediatric nurse, took us to the Robbins Library every single week. I remember when she handed me my first library card in kindergarten. She was very ceremonial about it. She bent down to my eye level, handed it to me gently like it was a relic, and she said, "As long as you have this library card, you will always have a friend." My parents' love of stories wasn't just limited to literature. My dad, a public defender whose parents emigrated from Ireland, thought the answer to every one of life's most important questions could be found in the lyrics of an Irish song. We were the first house in our neighborhood to get cable TV, and we always went to the movies as a family. When I graduated from college in 1990, I was clueless about what to do with my life. Because my father and both of my brothers were lawyers, I thought that I would just follow them into the family business. I then went on to get rejected by some of the finest law schools in the country, from Boston to Los Angeles and a few in between. I was crushed. I had no idea what to do next. So I asked the only non-lawyer in the house, my mom, for some advice. Being a good Boston Irish Catholic, she thought the answer was simple. If I couldn't go to law school, then I should go to the seminary. The only thing that could make her more proud of my being a lawyer was being a priest. But I opted for a different kind of ministry, and I moved to New York City, where I got a job selling stuffed animals at FAO Schwartz on Fifth Avenue. One day, my dad saw me on television. A national news program was filming a segment inside the store. At the time, I had been promoted, not to brag, but I was now in the video game department. And I made it into the final piece. When my dad saw me on national television playing The Legend of Zelda, wearing a purple smock that had a hobby horse with a teddy bear riding on top of it, he said to me in the words that only a dad from Massachusetts could say, "Son, it's time you got a job with the government and got on with your life." So I went back to Boston, and I found a job at the State House. On weekends, I volunteered with a great group called the Stepping Stone Foundation. It tutored children in some of Boston's poorest neighborhoods. It turned out to be the most influential job I've ever had. I began to learn a lot about the criminal failure of some schools to give kids the education that they deserve. But I also began to learn an even greater amount about the transformational power of stories. Before diving right into math or English, I used to break the ice those Saturday mornings by asking my students what they had done the night before. Invariably, they had gone to a movie or watched something on television. It seemed to be something different every week, and it was never very memorable. Until one Saturday morning, a couple of girls mentioned that they had seen Titanic. The next week, they had seen it again. And then the next week, something incredible happened. They didn't spend that night watching television or going to the movies. They went to a museum to see an exhibit on the Titanic. They learned about the people on the ship. They learned about how the ship was made. They talked about plunging their hands into cold water that was the same temperature as the Atlantic that fateful night. It quickly became clear to me that they were learning something far greater than names, dates, and facts. And they were learning something far more impactful than the reading comprehension and word problems that I was teaching. They were learning compassion. They learned that there wasn't much of a difference between an iceberg in the North Atlantic in 1912 and a gun on the city streets in Boston in 1998. Both could cut lives horribly short, and both could destroy families. Their heart didn't just break for Leonardo DiCaprio, but for every family on that ship. And they started to do something none of their school textbooks or workbooks had succeeded in doing. They began to ask the big questions. What would I do in that situation? Would I be brave? Would I be a coward? Would I be willing to make the ultimate sacrifice to lay down my life for another? These girls were now on the true path to learning and discovery, not because of anything I taught them that year. It was simply because they had spent a few hours watching a movie. About 1 year later, there was another event that left a powerful impression on me about the power of movies. On April 20th, 1999, two high school students in Littleton, Colorado, murdered 12 of their classmates and one of their teachers. They declared that day Natural Born Killers Day in celebration of a movie about serial killers that they watched over and over. They dressed in black trench coats in honor of another film that they watched religiously, The Basketball Diaries. That film had a scene in it where the lead character fantasized about donning a black trench coat, going to his school, and murdering his classmates as they sat there helplessly behind their desks. As the families mourned the loss of these innocent victims, the country quickly descended into one of those polarizing debates about the impact of the media. On the one side were those who claimed that it absolutely had an influence, and on the other there were the side of people who said it absolutely did not. The one thing missing from the debate was simple logic. I've never heard anybody dispute the fact that great art, films, songs, literature, the great hymn that we sang this morning, they make us better people, they can inspire us, and they can help us make good decisions. But if that's the case, then we must accept the corollary that art can also appeal to our darker nature. It can lead us away from the light, it can rob us of our happiness, and it can contribute to our making destructive and sometimes even deadly decisions. One story from that day had an especially strong impact on my life. It was the story of a young girl named Cassie Bernal, a born-again Christian. She was hiding in the library along with other students when one of the shooters approached her and pointed a shotgun in her face. "Do you believe in God?" he asked her. Without hesitation, staring down the barrel of a gun and facing certain death, Cassie said yes. That was the last word she ever spoke, as the shooter responded, "Well, go be with him." and ended her short life. When I heard Cassie's story, I was inspired, but I was also ashamed. If faced with the decision to deny God and live, or proclaim him and die, I realized I didn't know how I would answer. Despite a lifetime of going to church, I had not made that simple step of surrendering my life to Jesus and putting him in charge of my life. So one night, in late April 1999, I admitted that God was God, and I'd live my life for him. I began to read the Bible, and I began to notice something I'd never truly noticed before. Jesus loved stories. This was reflected in many of the questions that people brought to Jesus in his short ministry. We're familiar with most of them. What good do I have to do to attain eternal life? How many times should I forgive my enemy? And our favorite in Hollywood, what are you going to do for us? In his excellent book on prayer, the author Philip Yancey tallied the questions put to Jesus in the New Testament, and it came to a total of 183. Yet he only gave a direct answer to three of these questions. His usual way was to answer with a story. How should we treat our neighbors? Let me tell you the story about the Good Samaritan. How do we heal a broken family? Sit down. I'm going to tell you the story about the prodigal son. 20 centuries later, these stories remain with us. And so do many of the questions. And so in prayer, I began to turn for answers to that same first century rabbi. And I started to realize that he gives answers in the same way. Not quite as directly as I had wished, but in the roundabout way of parables, of the stories he writes in our own lives. I also began to understand that sometimes God answers our question in the stories of humanity's own making. Just as the Bible is the word of God and the words of man, the stories of inspired writers can sometimes capture a message that seems especially meant for us. The message can reach us not only through the red letter parables of the New Testament, but also in books or plays or music or even movies. Dorothy Day, the great Catholic nun, once said, "I don't think the Lord minds if we see him in books other than his book." I've often wondered whether some of these books, which seem to be so inspired, even exalted in their wisdom, whether our Lord hasn't had a close, direct hand in their creation. Maybe the best evidence that Dorothy was right, that God speaks to us in other works as well, comes from the efforts of various tyrants over the years who have tried to crush religious freedom and rid their lands of spiritual literature. Malcolm Muggeridge once related a conversation he had with a Russian dissident in the 1970s. He told Muggeridge that there was a spiritual revival happening in the Soviet Union. "I asked him how this could have happened," Muggeridge wrote, "given the enormous anti-religious brainwashing job that was done on all the citizens and the absence of all Christian literature, including the Gospels." His reply was memorable. "The authorities," he said, "forgot to suppress the works of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky." The story that was already imprinted on those Russian hearts, the story of an all-loving, all-powerful, all-forgiving God, was brought to life on those pages. The more that I read, the more that I began to see how all of the seemingly disparate experiences in my life, listening to Irish music with my dad, watching movies with my brothers, reading books with my mother, and teaching students in Boston, began to fit together for me like the pieces of a puzzle. Many of the films and books and songs that I had loved growing up, many of them were gently pointing me towards God. No longer did I see my love for teaching and my love for film as two separate things. I saw them as mutually reinforcing. Inspired by my newfound faith and supported by my hardworking wife, I decided to quit my job and start a film company that would inspire people to ask the big questions and set them on a path for truth. Great films could help accomplish what Plato saw as the true aim of education, the architecture of souls. There were just two problems with my plan to start a movie company. I never made and didn't know how to make a movie. And I didn't know how to start a company. My wife helped me solve the second problem. She went to Barnes & Noble and bought me a copy of Business Plans for Dummies. And an old friend from college, Carrie Granite, solved the first problem. I called him and told him about my idea of a film company that would inspire kids to learn. He told me he'd been dreaming about the same thing. Carrie is one of the most successful young executives in the film industry. As the president of Dimension Films, he was responsible for some of the most profitable films in the movie business. But they weren't exactly inspirational or educational classics. Some of the movies included Scream, Scary Movie, Children of the Corn 3, 4, 5, and 6. But Carrie was committed, and in a great display of faith and friendship, he left his profitable perch to start the company along with me and my big brother Chip, who at that time had joined the ranks of disgruntled attorney and wanted to do anything with his life other than practice the law. We visited every private equity firm and venture capital company that we could find. In keeping with my record for law school admissions, we were rejected by every one. The last meeting that we could afford was with a gentleman named Phil Anschutz in Denver. When we finished our presentation, Phil politely told us that he understood it. I thanked him for his time and asked him where we could find a taxi. He told me the taxi could wait because he was interested in funding the company. "You're kidding," I said. I was shocked. But it turned out that Phil also has a great love for literature and for history. He liked the idea of a company dedicated to making films based on great stories and great people. And so, in yet another unlikely leap of faith, Phil decided to fund a film company led by a successful horror movie producer and a part-time teacher. Since my only real work experience was in state government, I knew that any available jobs should go to your friends and your family. So I hired my brother Peter, a couple of friends from my wedding party, a few old roommates, and a buddy of mine from grammar school who played Charlie when I played Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory. I then called my wife and I asked her for some advice on what movies to make. She was a school teacher at St. Peter's School in South Boston, so she sent along her reading list from that year. On it were a number of great books: Charlotte's Web, Bridge to Terabithia, Holes, and The Chronicles of Narnia. These were among the first books that we optioned and went on to make films, and it all began with a fourth grade reading list. As I reread these classics, I quickly realized that these were more than just kids' books. They spoke to the very definition of faith given to us by the Apostle Paul. The substance of faith is a hope in the unseen. This moral imagination of children is a theme that we return to quite often at Walden. Whether it's Fern visiting her barn or little Lucy Pevensey visiting Narnia, our favorite storybook characters remind us of the nature of faith. And for those of us here who follow Jesus, this is something we can all relate to. We live in a cynical world. When we want to talk to people about things they cannot see with their own eyes or touch with their own hands, we always run the risk of people thinking that we're crazy, deluded because we pray to an invisible God. That's when we need to remember the wisdom of yet another inspired character, the fox who tells the little prince, "It is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye." The other great lesson we learn from children's literature is that all things are possible, despite what the skeptics would lead us to believe. This is an especially valuable lesson to remember for those of you who will be graduating this year or in the years to come. There's no need to recite all of the challenges that you're going to face. You're reminded of those on an hourly basis. But what you are not told about is all of the opportunities that await you. And further, you're probably not told about how your education here at BYU and this wonderful community of believers that you're a part of has uniquely positioned you for great success. Let me give you one real-life example. The best part of my job is our intern program. Every year, we're blessed to have some of the best students from across the country spend a few months to work with us. Like all great educational exchanges, the teachers learn more from the students than the students learn from us. Two times now, we've had interns from BYU, Laura Stowell and Raven Allard. And it's no coincidence that they've been two of our best. Last summer, I brought our interns into our screening room to show them the new trailer from our latest Narnia movie, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. We'd been working on the trailer for months, and we were working with the marketing department at 20th Century Fox for several weeks to come up with a strategy to ensure that our trailer had a great debut online. In the movie business today, one of the greatest indicators of success is how many people will watch your trailer once you release it on the internet. We were all proud of the reception our trailer received. I boasted about the number to our interns. And in just 1 week, I bragged, we've had over 800,000 people watch our trailer. Several of our interns started to giggle, and they looked back at Raven, our BYU intern. She exchanged an uncomfortable smile, and she politely looked away from them. I couldn't help but ask, what's so funny? Raven was too modest to say anything, so one of the other interns spoke up. Raven also produced a video last week, and she released it on YouTube, they said. Raven started to look even more uncomfortable in her seat, and she was shifting back and forth. Good for you, Raven, I said, summoning up some patronizing support. What was it about? Our new library at BYU. I just did it with a couple of friends in one afternoon, and we posted it on Friday. Oh, the library, that's so cute. How's it doing? I asked her. Raven again looked at her desk, and she was not going to give me the answer to this question. But every other intern was more than proud to do it. She got over 1 million views in just 3 days, they said. And 2 million views in 1 week, another person chimed in. It was one of the most powerful illustrations I'd ever seen about how quickly our media landscape is shifting. We had spent several years making a movie. We had committed over $200 million to produce it and market it. We had the best minds in the business spending several months determined to make sure that our online debut was a success. And in our narrow view, it was. Yet just a few kids in Provo, all of them less than half our age, working on a budget of about $500, and as Raven was quick to point out, we also bought everyone a free lunch. Well, they created something that quickly won a much bigger audience than our trailer. We had fire-breathing dragons, a mouse that was a champion swordsman. We even had a talking lion that forgave for people's sins. But we lost in the battle for the bigger audience to a student video about a college library. That was the day it became clear to me that everything had officially changed. Hollywood was no longer the center of the entertainment industry. The day that films were going to be produced and marketed almost exclusively from there had ended. And the day that some of them would be produced and marketed from Provo had begun. Just as the places where these films are being produced are multiplied, so too are the kinds and the lengths of films that people enjoy. Entertainment's no longer limited to 30-minute sitcoms, hour-long medical dramas, or two-hour movies. Films as short as 1 minute can be just as inspiring, impactful, and influential. And with today's technology, they can be seen by hundreds of millions of people. This is something that our boss, Phil Anschutz, has always understood. He started the Foundation for a Better Life to create short videos and billboards to demonstrate the rewards of great virtues in action. The foundation's run by one of my really good friends, Gary Dixon, who actually has 2 children that are students here at the Y. These videos have been seen by literally billions of people across the planet. I want to share with you one of my favorites.
It takes a lot to know what is love.
All right, don't hold back now. Give me all you got.
Oh. There is never a day.
Maybe baseball is your game.
Hey, pal, run it in right here.
You were always there for me.
How about golf? Okay, choke down a little bit.
Guiding me,
right?
Always to succeed. Wanna thank you for that.
A appreciation, pass it on. A message from the Foundation for a Better Life.
A lot of those videos are shot here in Utah, and that one was directed by a BYU graduate, a great filmmaker named Grant Beard, who's also here today with us. And I feel like there's more in that one video than there is in a library full of books and films combined. Like a great children's book, there's more to it than meets the eye. It teaches us two great lessons that go well beyond being a loving and dedicated mother and a resilient child. First, it tells us that we're going to encounter many failures as we pursue our passion and our vocation. We'll get knocked down, we'll get discouraged, and we're even going to break stuff on our way to get there. Second, we learn that one of the greatest things we can do in this life is to help people discover their true gifts and talents. These gifts were theirs since before time. They've been a part of them since their Creator first knitted them in their mother's womb. For me, that's the ultimate power of a good story. It can help us find meaning and help us become the people that God created us to be. I'd like to conclude with one of our few films that's not based on a children's book. The film was called Amazing Grace, after the famous piece by John Newton. After hearing the song, I always assumed that Newton had experienced a complete and instant conversion to Christianity. But it turns out the story was a little more complicated, and his conversion was a little more drawn out. Newton is best described in his own words, an infidel, a libertine, and a slave trader. One night as he was sailing back to England, his ship started to fill with water and was about to capsize. Newton prayed to God for help, and the ship was miraculously saved. By the time he got back to England, Newton was reading his Bible daily. He went to church on Sundays. He stopped gambling. He stopped smoking. He stopped swearing. I bet he even stopped dancing. But for more than three more decades, he continued in the slave trade. For all of his newfound insight and proper behavior, he didn't at first see any need for a career change, but instead resolved to be the most moral slave trader in all of England. For his time and place, this didn't seem like an outrageous contradiction. How could it be, when neither the law, nor the crown, nor even parts of the church would condemn slavery as evil? By all outward appearances, Newton could be considered an upstanding Christian in mid-18th century England. It was in prayer, however, that the truth broke through. Not in a flash, but over time. Like the prophet Samuel before him, Newton learned that the Lord doesn't look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Finally, after many years, the things that broke God's heart began to break John Newton's heart. He became a dedicated abolitionist, a trusted friend to William Wilberforce, and of course, the author of Amazing Grace. With that first prayer from a stricken ship, a whole new story was set in motion. The slave trade lost its most upright merchant, and the world gained its most beautiful hymn. That's the power of prayer. And saving a ship was the least of the miracle. Prayer can be subversive in that way. It doesn't always advance our ambitions, but sometimes can even undermine them and set us in an entirely new direction. As we part today and get back to the hectic pace of day-to-day life, I hope we'll each find time to enjoy some great stories. And I know that some of you in this audience will go on to create them. And through these stories and through our daily prayer, I hope that we'll all follow the story that God has written for each of us. It's the perfect story, and we're his collaborators, needing help even to help ourselves. For just as William Clayton said in the beautiful hymn we all sang this morning, soon we will all have a tale to tell. All is well, all is well. Thank you so much.